We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We all recognize those famous words from the Declaration of Independence of 1776, and we probably know the phrase about our unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But how many of us actually read the whole document or think about its implications for us today? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. The Declaration of Independence of 1776 stands as one of the most important documents in the history of government. Who besides Thomas Jefferson had a hand in its creation? And how did the group process of writing work? How do we reconcile the hypocrisy of slaveholders writing about liberty? How did God get into the Declaration? Joining me to take a new look at the Declaration of Independence is Professor Danielle Allen. She is a political philosopher known for her work on justice and citizenship from ancient Athens to modern America, and she is the director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard. Books she has written include World of Prometheus, The Politics of Punishing in Democratic Athens, Talking to Strangers, Anxieties of Citizenship Since Brown v. Board of Education, and her recent book, Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks so much, Emily. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've got to start by asking you why you came up with this idea of writing an entire book about a document that's just a few pages long.
I know, it's slightly embarrassing. The document's only 1,337 words, and I've managed to turn that into 300 pages. So at any rate, the short answer is I had this magical teaching experience with adult learners in Chicago and a course called the Odyssey Project. And we read the Declaration in history classes and literature classes in the context of talking about philosophy. They did not know it to start. They'd never read it. They were mostly adults of color at the poverty line. I was surprised by the fact that they didn't know it. And there was resistance to the document for all the reasons you indicated, and written by white slave owners and so forth. And yet it touched them profoundly. And for me, working with them around the text, I was touched profoundly by their experience with it and learned a lot from it, and in particular about the concept of equality. And I wanted to share that. I wanted to somehow make that experience of conversation that we had had about the text available to everybody. So that was the inspiration for the book. It was an effort to represent, in some sense, less the document than the conversations that the document inspired.
And as you know, I direct the Odyssey Project here in Madison, which is somewhat similar in targeting adults at the poverty level. And we also find that the Declaration of Independence is one of those documents that start out with thinking, oh no, the founding fathers, the dead white men, those slaveholders. But then the words themselves kind of jump off the page, especially the ones, as you point out in your book, about freedom and equality.
They do. And for me, I mean, another important part of the story that's come to have more pressing urgency for me since I wrote the book is that it's not Jefferson's text and it's not Jefferson's story. That's partly because of the words themselves and what we can all do with them. But it's also actually because John Adams was a hugely important part of the story of how the Declaration came to be. John Adams was a man of Massachusetts. He never held slaves. He thought slaveholding was a bad thing. So his voice is as much in the Declaration as Jefferson's. And I think we really need to dispel the view that all of the voices of the founding were the voices of slave owners. There were a lot of voices of people who thought slavery was a bad thing, and we need to hear their voices in the texts as well.
It's hard to imagine that a document as eloquent as the Declaration of Independence is could be written by committee, because I think many of us have had an experience, let's say, with writing a grant where you get multiple people involved and they have their own kind of voice, and it can become a kind of monster. But somehow this group project worked.
That's a great question. I mean, there are a lot of things to say about that. I mean, I think there is beauty in the Declaration, and it's surprising for exactly the reason that you said. It's written by committee. Jefferson is the chair of the committee, but it's a committee of five, and the others have edits, and then the draft goes to Congress, and Congress cuts out 25% of it. So how on earth in that kind of process can you have a thing of beauty? And then also, secondly, I mean, there's just the question of what does it mean to write as a group anyway in the first place? So what kind of beauty is there in the text and how did they get it? The nature of the beauty, I think, actually reflects the fact that they've been kind of hammering out the ideas in the document for several years. So it's not as if they just sort of sat down at the last minute and sort of tried to write it. What they'd been hammering out was the question of how to explain to themselves their profound desire to be the authors of their own lives and their own world. They really resented the impositions of the king and parliament, and they needed to have an account for that. And they literally, I mean, there are sort of drafts of the declaration in a certain sense that have been written for each of the preceding years when they write to the king and explain their complaints and explain why they think they have should have a different way of life. So that long-standing process is one that they were doing collectively, and they could only do collectively, because having an alternative to monarchy requires becoming good at conversation. Those are sort of things that go together. If you're going to try to do democracy or a republic or something like that, you have to be good at conversation. And so I think it's that conversational power, the ability to develop formulations that everybody could go along with, even if they had their reservations and disagreements about them, that is the source of the beauty in the text. There are also contradictions in the text, and you can't iron out contradictions in a process of group writing. So that makes the kind of beauty that you get in this sort of text very different from what you get from a single poet or a single novelist or a single philosopher. And one has to accept that difference.
I was struck because, you know, you're an academic, you know, University of Chicago and then Princeton and then Harvard, but it's written in a much more readable, personal way, where you may be bringing in a bullying grandmother to show something about tyranny, or a husband and wife conversation, or referring to the break from Britain as like a divorce. What led you to sort of put this personal voice? I mean, my sense of it is that the Declaration of Independence for you is something very personal, too.
Thank you. No, that's a very rich question. So I think there are two parts of the answer to that. I mean, the first is, I said to start, I was trying to represent a conversation. And my teaching voice is very different from the voice I had used as a scholar to write my scholarly books. And so this book was the first time I really tried to write out of my teaching voice. And when you're in a room with students, I mean, you just are yourself as a whole human being. And so you share your own stories and you share your perspectives on the world, and that becomes part of how you build the conversation about whatever you're studying, the Declaration or Sophocles or Plato or whatever it is. So that it was partly that it was an effort to capture my teaching voice. But then there's a second reason that led me to a sort of fuller account of myself, basically, a feeling that I had to tell people who I was behind these views of the Declaration. I make an argument in the book that the Declaration has a coherent account of the concept of equality. And I also make the argument that in our public conversations, we're not very good at talking about equality any longer. Liberty has taken such precedence that our muscles for thinking about equality have atrophied. And I wanted to rectify that. So that's, in some sense, a kind of strong argument about our contemporary situation and so forth. And I thought it wasn't fair to make that argument without showing people who I was. So who is this person behind this argument? Because I wasn't grounding my argument about equality in God, and I wasn't grounding my argument about equality in some sort of law of nature that was, you know, sort of external to us. I wasn't grounding it in some pre-existing kind of metaphysical tradition. I was grounding my argument on equality based on my observations about our country, my efforts to talk with other people in our country about what is justice and what is fairness and so forth. And so I thought that being sort of true and honest about the source of my views was critical to explaining to people what had been presented to them.
And would you say that being biracial, you came at the Declaration in a different way?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, it's so hard to say which parts of one's background mean that one has a different perspective. It's certainly the case that being biracial means, I think, that, you know, there are moments where you are forced to ask questions about identity that may be slightly different from the questions that other people ask. So, am I black? Am I white? How do I think about those things? I come to understand myself as black, but what does that mean about the white side of myself? And how do I reconcile the different streams of our country's political history in my own person? Sort of, what does the fact that my parents were able to meet and get married married in California, although it was illegal still in other parts of the country. You know, what does that mean for thinking about equality and fairness and justice? It, you know, sort of being biracial does provoke a set of questions, I suppose, that probably lead one down an unusual path.
I noticed as I read through the book that you don't get to the second sentence of the Declaration until something like page 149.
Exactly.
The first sentence,
yes.
Which is, I found it a magnificent example of close reading. Just
right.
How, I mean, I'll never go back to the first sentence of the Declaration and see it in the same way. And I'm wondering if you could read that first sentence and then
sure.
Break it down.
Okay. I'll do my best, although you know, that's kind of entering into dangerous territory because that's exactly how my classes started. I just started out trying to read it. And then we would read the first sentence and then we would realize it's long and complicated and we couldn't just read it and move on. And so next thing, you know, you'll be here for 3 weeks if you're not careful, Emily. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. It's a long sentence to hold in your head. That long subordinate clause to start off, right? You know, the whole "when in the course of human events" clause. You have to try to remember that till you get all the way to the conclusion of the sentence, namely that a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
It's interesting, too, that they choose not to start out with any reference to King George or the colonies or Britain or America. It's human history and sort of they start at a very general level.
Exactly. So I remember in our first class when we were talking about the Declaration, the very first question that came up was, why did they say when in the course of human events? Why didn't they just say when? You know, why do you need all those extra words? And so that does speak to a certain responsibility they took on themselves, which is they thought that they had to diagnose their circumstances, right? So that's what that language is about. The course of human events is sort of like a doctor surveying a patient to say, you know, the course of this disease or, you know, the course of this effort at health and well-being. You know, you have to look at the whole situation and determine its meaning before you can choose a course of action. And so they were conveying that responsibility to considered judgment about their circumstances.
You also, in your book, relate course to the flow of a river.
Mm-hmm. Which they did as well. I mean, this was another fun thing about the book project was that I started digging into almanacs from the 18th century. And so after the Bible, almanacs, which gave farmers year-long predictions about the weather, were the books that circulated the most in the colonies. And they tended to be illustrated with etchings of various kinds. And I was astonished how frequently those almanacs, you know, which were about time, the calendar of the year, invoked images of rivers and waterways to talk about time. And the point that they were driving home over and over again, you know, life rushes on, it flows on. Yet to succeed at it, to flourish, each of us is sort of trying to see what's coming in the future, right? We're trying to understand those currents in life so that we can organize our own choices in relationship to them. And so that metaphor of time as a river was worked well through the cultural fabric of the 18th century.
Okay, so we've got the course of human events flowing along here, and then this reference to one people, that it's necessary for one people to dissolve bands connecting them to another. At this point, when they're talking about one people, who's included?
That's a great question. So I love that moment when we hear the one people, because there are lots of scholars who have said, you know, there was no such thing as the people of the United States or whatever before the Declaration. It didn't even come into existence until into the Revolutionary War. And I think this opening refutes that right from the get-go, they're describing themselves as one people. But who's in that? I mean, you're sort of asking questions of exclusions of women, exclusions of slaves and Native Americans and so forth. And the people who are in it are the people at this point who are participating in the networks of conversation that are yielding shared decisions. So you've got Continental Congress in Philadelphia, which has been operating for 2 years by now. Each of the colonies is sending delegates to Congress, and those delegates think of themselves as having a responsibility to their families, their extended families. And so that means men and women are included in this one people, but slaves, Native Americans, are not included in this one people.
Well, let's tackle that phrase, separate and equal station. which you talk about later, and I know you wrote a whole book about the Brown v. Board of Education separate but equal argument, but this is separate and equal, and it refers to separate and equal station.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an audacious statement at this point for them to be saying we are separate and we're equal to, it would be Britain and France and Spain. And,
exactly. It's an extraordinary statement. I mean, you know, they're puny. Their populations are a small percentage of the populations of Britain and France and Spain and so forth. And those empires have huge militaries. They don't have anything to set against that. So it raises the question of exactly what does this claim of equality consist of? And there's only one thing that it can consist of, and it's the fact that they have acquired the capacity for self-government. They have organized themselves to make decisions together. That's it. That's the bare essence of the thing that leads them to say to everybody else, we are your equals, keep out. Right? They put up a sort of no trespassing sign, basically. And that is, I mean, people connect that to the ideas that came out of what's called the Westphalian state system. So in the early modern period, you have the different states of Europe developing as states and exactly putting up those sort of no trespass signs. You know, these are our borders. We're going to make our own decisions internally to them. Don't bother us. And so that's basically what they're tapping into. But the important thing is that for them, it's not just that they take this idea of wanting to be free from domination by others and apply it to themselves as a group. They also use that for how they're understanding equality amongst themselves, that as individuals, they want to be free from domination. And so that idea of having the capacity for self-government to direct your own life gets sort of pulled into the fabric of the meaning of equality at the very, very beginning. And yes, I mean, you pointed to an important contradiction. We go from the separate and equal station, which, you know, gives us equality, to the use of a sort of twisted rhetoric of separate but equal to justify segregation and Jim Crow, and the use of separation precisely to subordinate some people to others. So this country has not understood its ideals in their fullest sense and has, you know, to the degree of distorting them and abusing them badly.
Well, then we come up to the phrase, the laws of nature and of nature's God. That is, you know, referred to in terms of where the entitlement to this separate and equal station comes from. It comes from the laws of nature and of nature's God. Why, first of all, why the double reference? And why do you think the authors of the Declaration chose at this point not to just say God or the divine?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are two great compromises in the Declaration of Independence. One is around religion and the other is around slavery. But let's just focus on the one around religion for the moment. I mean, I think of this as the belt and suspenders phrase, the laws of nature and nature's God. So the Declaration makes very big claims about human beings and very big claims about what's just, what's fair in relationship to human beings. What's the basis for those claims? It gives us two options here. Nature on the one hand, namely, you know, this is what human beings are like, and we can see that by looking at human history through time immemorial, and then make judgments about what the right thing to do is based on that. That's one possible ground of justification. The other is God, that God tells us something about human beings, and based on that, we have an obligation to God, and therefore this gives us our sort of moral outlook. So they don't choose, right? They use both of those justifications. And the reason for that is that they were having debates and arguments about that. There wasn't consensus around the place of God in thinking about the new founding. The committee that was chosen to draft the Declaration consisted of people who considered themselves deists. So Jefferson, that was a little tricky. He never sort of explicitly avowed that, but that was effectively his position. And Franklin, who was a self-avowed deist.
And define that for us.
Thank you. So a deist, a person who does think that there's a sort of divinity at the font of nature, but is more interested in the concept of nature for understanding the rules of human society.
Would that be like the watchmaker God, the God that has sort of created the world, but then sort of left the picture?
Left the picture, exactly. And it's not a doctrinal view. So it's not a Christian view. It's not a Jewish view. It's not a Muslim view. So deism is in some sense compatible with a variety of the world's religions, but it's not dependent on any of them. On the other hand, you had people like John Adams and Roger Sherman, who were very pious Christians. So you had, you know, all those people all participating in the committee to draft the Declaration and trying to figure out, well, what's the right way of talking about the things that, you know, we've agreed we believe. So, you know, we've agreed that we are committed to an idea of equality. We've agreed that we're committed to an idea of our ownership of our political system and so forth. But what's the basis for those views? And that they couldn't agree on. So instead of agreeing, they produced language that was open to both interpretations. And that's an incredible thing to think about, that mm-hmm. they compromised. They truly did. And they wrote something that was open for those who wanted to give a Christian interpretation to the document, but neither did it require it. Hugely important compromise.
After saying that the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them to this separate and equal station, then the Declaration goes on to say that a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. I was fascinated in your book that you call the Declaration a memo.
Mm-hmm.
Does that phrase sort of say, here's a memo and we're going to tell you the reasons? Or why exactly. did you call it a memo?
You know, the fun thing is, I've actually, since finishing this, found a British newspaper that calls the Declaration a memo. It says, you look at those colonials, look what they've gotten up to. They're sending a memoranda to the whole world about their decision to declare war on Britain. So yes, it's a memo in the sense that it's sharing with the world a course of action and justifying it. I mean, that's what memos do. I mean, short for memoranda, which is the thing that needs to be remembered in Latin for that. And its purpose is to sort of put the world on notice. But they're going beyond putting the world on notice, right? I mean, so they're actually not just putting people on notice about their action, but justifying it, inviting the world to judge their actions. This is fundamental because it speaks to the ground of their own political claims, namely the view that human beings have the capacity to make political judgments. We therefore have a responsibility to do so in setting the course of our lives. We have to judge what the right course is. And we have to be open to the judgments of others about our choices. So they are practicing what they preach, basically, by declaring their causes to the whole world and inviting judgment.
And they're kind of patting themselves on the back, too. They're saying, you know, that we're decent, we're respectful.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to share this with you. So they're kind of presenting themselves as reasonable beings here, even though they're declaring revolution.
They are presenting themselves as reasonable beings, but I read the sentence slightly differently insofar as, say, a decent respect requires that we declare the causes. I understand themselves to be making a mental note to themselves of a set of responsibilities that they have.
Well, we made it through the first sentence, and the second sentence
exactly.
is actually the most famous sentence in the Declaration, and we're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
That's the famous second sentence of the Declaration of Independence. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Professor Danielle Allen, and we are talking about her book, Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in defense of equality. I mentioned that it took you 149 pages in your book to get to this second sentence. It is probably the most famous one.
It certainly is.
That phrase, all men are created equal,
yes,
has a special place in world history. As you continued reading it, I realized that most of us kind of stop after life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of just kept going and going. I was very impressed that you didn't get out of breath.
it's
a long one.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, you have to practice this sentence before you read it out loud, I think. It is a long one. Five clauses, five self-evident truths, not three. We tend to lose track that there are five.
Well, let's start with the part, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Does that mean they're sort of begging the question and just saying, well, here's some truths and they're so obvious that we're just going to call them self-evident and not have to prove them?
So no, it's not that at all, actually. I mean, it's a much more technical meaning. They were students of logic. They loved, actually, the 18th century England and the colonies loved a book by Isaac Watts about logic. You can go check it out and it will help you know what self-evidence is. Basically, it's the notion that you take a set of propositions, and together, if you consider them in relationship to each other, they have the evidence internally to them to explain and justify the conclusion.
Like a syllogism.
Like a syllogism, exactly. So a syllogism is a philosopher's name for an argument that consists of a premise, first premise, a second premise, and then a conclusion. So the traditional example is Socrates is a human being, premise one, human beings are mortal, or will die, premise two, therefore Socrates will die, conclusion. So you don't need anything outside of those three premises to be able to judge whether the conclusion is valid. So that's what self-evidence is about. And that's what's happening here too. We have a set of premises that issue in a conclusion. The conclusion is whenever any form of government becomes destructive of the ends of securing our rights, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Okay. But it starts out by saying we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Let's just start with that phrase.
Yep.
How is that a truth that doesn't need to be proven? And what exactly is meant by created equal if people are being born into unequal situations?
So the sentence answers the question, or the phrase, the clause rather, answers the question as to in what sense we're created equal. So the first three that clauses are all part of a single premise in that syllogism. So let me just go ahead and read them again. That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So each, the second and third clauses are explaining the first one. So created equal, what does that mean? Okay, well, the creator made us equal by endowing us with unalienable rights. Well, what are those rights? Rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, among others, right? It's important that among these are. This is not an exhaustive list. It's an example. It's just giving us examples of what our rights are. So, okay, what does that mean exactly? If we are equal in having a set of rights that we get from the moment that we come into existence, those rights include among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It means that if you, you know, look around the world and look at, you know, sort of human beings, you'll find that there's no human being out there that's not trying to survive freely, free from domination, and to survive in a way that counts as flourishing. I mean, so it's, we're hardwired to do that.
So these are kind of our expectations or dreams or wishes.
I think it goes beyond expectations or dreams or wishes. It's just what we are trying to do. And it is what makes us human insofar as if when we're thwarted from surviving, thwarted from surviving as free individuals, thwarted from surviving in a way that permits us to pursue our flourishing, our actual human capacities have been undone. So our human capacities are helping us to achieve these things, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If when those get blocked, it's our basic human capacities that are getting blocked.
Well, now might be a good time to talk about slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because if all men are created equal and have a right to liberty, then why are so many at this time in history, including some of Thomas Jefferson's own slaves, why are they in bondage? And how did the whole issue of slavery somehow get taken out of this declaration?
Mm-hmm. So again, you know, there's so much to say on that subject. So you're probably gonna have to stop me because I can go on and on that particular subject. So where to begin? The first question is there hypocrisy in this sentence? Because obviously at the same time that this declaration was passed unanimously and declared, there were people being held in bondage. There was hypocrisy on the part of some, and there was straightforward conviction on the part of others. So again, let me draw the contrast between Jefferson and Adams. For Jefferson, this was, when he wrote this sentence, it was an expression of hypocrisy. When Adams talked about this sentence with him, wrote similar sentences, endorsed it, it was a statement of straightforward conviction. He didn't hold slaves. He thought slavery was a bad thing. So they had acquired a moral view. Some of them had been able to internalize that to such a level that they were orienting their own life habits around it in a full way. Others were not able to change their life habits around it. Dickinson, after the passing of the Declaration of Independence, although he ended up leaving Congress, also freed his slaves. So he was the only member of Continental Congress to do so at this time. But the movement towards abolition began. So we do now have people working on abolition in Pennsylvania after this and so forth. So it's a mistake to see the Declaration as merely a hypocritical document. It did also, for a lot of people, actually help spur them further in the abolitionist direction.
But isn't it also true that there was originally in some draft going to be something about, you know, attacking King George for having encouraged a practice of buying and selling human beings?
Yes, absolutely. There, in the first draft of the Declaration that Jefferson and his committee colleagues submitted to Congress, there was a paragraph condemning King George for the slave trade, for keeping open markets in men, and violating, in the language of that draft, the sacred rights of life and liberty of a distant people, the Africans. And so that's important because exactly the same language that's used to convey the rights and liberties of the colonists, this language of there being sacred rights, is used for the people being transported out of Africa. So that is a good evidence that they recognize that these rights applied even to enslaved Africans. There's then a long, Congress cut it out. I say they recognized it. The committee that submitted the draft recognized it. Congress cut that passage out. That's when I said there are sort of compromises in the document around slavery. That's one of the important compromises. That was the pro-slavery compromise in drafting the Declaration, the excision of that passage of condemnation. The anti-slavery compromise was the use of the language of rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness instead of language of life, liberty, and property. The move from property to the pursuit of happiness was a move away from the slave position. The Virginians were already using the idea of the right of property as a part of their defense of slavery, and by keeping it out of the Declaration, we got that pro-slave argument and defense out of the Declaration. And John Adams is really the person that we have to thank for that. He had been working for the preceding year on convincing everybody that happiness was the right term around which to organize this story of fundamental rights.
I think you even mentioned that Abigail Adams may have played a bit of a role here, too, with some suggestions.
Exactly. I mean, actually, the conversations between John and Abigail are super fascinating. And there's a lot that we can learn about this issue of the gap between the principles and the lived reality from their conversations. So when Abigail learned in a letter from John that the Declaration was starting to move forward, her response was, well, that's terrific. You know, I've been pushing for this all along. But now what about the women? And John's response was, you know, yes, you're right, but it's the men's job to make sure that, you know, all women have these rights. Yes, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it's our job to figure out the governmental form that will provide those for women. So in other words, if you look at that second sentence again, look at the very end of the sentence, there's this critical distinction between, let's have a look at it. You institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as shall seem to you most likely to affect safety and happiness. So John and Abigail agreed that the principles were that all men, including women, had rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The disagreement was on the form of government that would secure that. And John's view was men could be in charge of government and secure rights for everybody. And he wrote this in letters to other people as well, making that distinction between principles and form. And Abigail's response to him was, all right, okay, but you men don't have such a good track record of securing the rights of women. So you'd better do a better job this time, because otherwise we will, and in her words, foment for voice and representation. So right from the get-go, they knew that there was an issue about the gap between the principles and the form of government, and they knew that there could well be tension around that gap. And Abigail was, in effect, predicting the future, that it would be necessary for all people to have direct voice and representation in order for the form of government to make good on the fundamental principles.
It's too bad Abigail Adams didn't live to read Elizabeth Cady Stanton's rewriting of the Declaration.
Yes.
To have it be all men and women are created equal, and then to go through a list of grievances against men rather than King George.
Exactly,
she would have enjoyed that,
I think. That's right. I think she would have.
I was struck in your book with pictures that you include of manuscripts that are basically drafts with lots of changed phrases. You know, we assume it sort of always was this, all men are created equal in the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and, you know, words that are in there. But then we see these earlier versions that maybe said inherent instead of unalienable, mm-hmm. and show them working through different ways to come at it. Mm-hmm. When you were looking at all these different drafts, what struck you about some of the changes? Did you see anything that where you actually liked the original wording better? Or
that's an interesting question. Well, I do miss the condemnation of the slave trade,
yes.
that's for sure. I wish they hadn't cut that out. Although it must be said that it was actually a double-edged thing. I mean, I won't go into it now, but it wasn't. Anyway, it's sort of double-edged. But so, yes, I was sorry that they excised the condemnation of the slave trade and sorry that they excised the language of the sacred rights of life and liberty of the people of Africa. The other thing I think that's so interesting in the language is that the shifts are really, I mean, there are two other categories of shift aside from the stuff around the slavery language. They reduce the amount of time Jefferson had spent on sort of the relationship of sibling love between the colonists and the British. So they sort of pull out that kind of romantic story. And the other really critical thing is this very subtle change in the language around God and religion in the Declaration. So in the first draft, the truths are sacred and undeniable rather than being self-evident. But in that draft, the Creator's not there either. So they, when they bring the Creator in, they also shift from sacred and undeniable to self-evident. Self-evident puts the burden on human intelligence, human reasoning for understanding the conclusions that should govern our action. So they really maintain this very, very careful balance between, you know, making space for God, but actually also putting the responsibility on human beings to understand their circumstances, talk through their options, and come to agreement amongst themselves about what to do.
You mentioned that in addition to the sort of multiple authors on the committee, that even a clerk can play a role just in transcribing it onto parchment.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. Now, again, you know, it's amazing. There's so many tidbits attached to the story of the Declaration that I think we don't really kind of know yet. And there's still so much to be known and learned. The man who penned the famous parchment for the signatures was a guy named Timothy Matlack, who was a clerk in Congress, very entrepreneurial fellow. So he didn't just do documents. Anytime it's sort of, you know, you read through the records of Congress and you sort of see him popping up anytime Congress has a problem it can't quite solve, he's like, I'll do it. And so by the end of the Revolutionary War, he's very rich. So he's doing things like providing salt and figuring out how to supply munitions as well as writing documents. Again, very enterprising sort of individual. But at any rate, when he comes to draft the parchment, there's an important moment after, at the end of the list of grievances, when they summarize their complaints, they say, in every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. When they say that in all of the drafts that we have petitioned, it's just a lowercase we. But when we get to Matlack's parchment, he capitalizes it. And I sort of see that as a moment. That's where we the people is born. This moment when we the people petitions the king for a change. And then when he doesn't respond appropriately, move in a new direction. That was Matlack's contribution. There's no other way to see it coming into the document. And so I read that as his statement about his own participation in the development of this new people. This new political entity.
We're going to talk about some of the grievances that get stated against tyranny when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shewn that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
That's from the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Danielle Ellen, and we are talking about her book, Our Declaration, A Reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality. Boy, they like those long sentences, but
I know.
Basically hear them saying, you know, usually we put up with stuff.
That's right.
But when it gets to be too much,
enough's
it's time
enough.
To split.
Exactly. That's right. Enough's enough. That's right.
I think any time that I've heard the Declaration taught in a class, as we do in the Odyssey Project, we never make it past that point. We never go on, as you do in your book, to actually go through this whole long list of, what is it, 13 or something,
grievances
yeah. against King George, mainly because they seem dated. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have to worry about soldiers coming and eating food in our house,
right.
you know, that kind of thing. So it just seems like the part you skip.
Right.
What value is there to kind of go through these grievances?
Oh, gosh, I just think it's so important. And so the most important thing about the grievances is that they're actually a constitutional theory. And so if you read them out loud, you start to realize that they've been grouped. Right? They're not just kind of higgledy-piggledy in terms of how they're listed. First, you get a lot of complaints about the legislative function of government, and then you get complaints about the judicial function, and then you get complaints about the executive function of government. And then lastly, you get complaints about the violations of the law of war. And realizing that as early as July 1776, they were operating with that kind of constitutional theory is really important. So I've often heard people say, well, when they, you know, declared independence, they didn't know yet if they wanted a monarchy or a democracy, and they just wanted to be free of Great Britain. And that's not the case, actually. When you read the grievances, you realize they'd already answered that question for themselves. They wanted a separation of powers. And once you want separation of powers, you can't have a monarchy by definition. So at any rate, I think recognizing their commitments to democratic government, that's what you get out of the grievances, and that's fundamental.
So you see it as not only that they're complaining that this is what King George and Great Britain, you know, are doing, but also that they're sort of in, by showing the negative, they're establishing what a government should look like.
Exactly. I mean, I think of it as sort of an inside-out theory, or a sort of upside-down or inverted mirror-opposite theory of good government. So if you go through the list and ask yourself, you know, what's really wrong conceptually with each of these things? Like, so let's forget about the actual incidents that happened. You know, say they're complaining that the king made the legislature move to a new area where they were far away from their public records and all their written minutes of their meetings. You know, leave aside the details of that and just ask what's wrong conceptually. What's wrong is that a legislature that doesn't have access to its records can't function. So it just disables the ability of people to choose their laws, to debate them, to hold people to account for failing to live up to them, and that sort of thing. So if you go through each one and sort of ask about that kind of core kernel of an idea, you do actually get a theory of good government. And is that to say that it's a complete theory of good government? Not necessarily, but it's certainly a reasonable starting point, and it's actually not that different from what we get in the Constitution. So there's been this view that the Declaration of Independence took us in one direction, and importantly, in a pro-equality direction, and that the Constitution then kind of backed up and took us in another direction, a pro-liberal direction. And so if you really scrutinize the grievances, I think what you actually find is that the liberty and equality concepts were fused from the get-go. And it's not that the Declaration goes one way and the Constitution the other. The Declaration is the statement of principles, the Articles of Confederation first, and then the Constitution second, where the organization of form. They were trying to put principles and form together.
So if you were King George reading this, and you read this whole list of somewhat hyperbolic grievances, wouldn't you think, boy, they're whining about, you know, paying taxes, and they're just self-interested here? I mean, if you were trying to look at it from the other side, if you're looking at it from Great Britain, that feels it has been so helpful to these colonists who are, after all, coming from England, What do you think the reaction would have been to the same language that we might see as, you know, so brave? And
well, it's, you know, it's a terrific question. I mean, there are all kinds of complexities. You know, there's people know the movie Madness of King George. And so the question of what King George would have thought is slightly complicated.
Never mind. Exactly.
But that's important, yes. Right? Because everybody in England is like having to deal with a king who's not in control of his circumstances or situation. So the problem of the colonies should have been manageable for the British Empire. They failed. There's no question mm-hmm. about the fact that the British monarchy failed at this moment. So that said, I mean, there were people in Britain who thought the colonies had a good case. Mm-hmm. They were in the minority. The majority thought that the colonists were, that it was a scurrilous document. And there's this hysterical sort of satire of it, a complete rewriting of it that was published later that summer, which uses exactly the same setup, you know, went in the course of human events all the way through to make the case that the colonists are sort of criminals and completely self-concerned and fail to recognize bonds of obligation and duty and that kind of thing. So certainly it was considered an unjustified act of war.
Well, let's look at after the whole list of all the things that, you know, King George has done wrong. The, you know, different taxes, different lack of representation, different sort of forms of harassment and so on. What happens at the end of the declaration if we make it that far?
At the very end of the declaration, they mutually pledge their lives, their liberties, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. So the end of the declaration is really the beginning of the declaration, is the way I think of it. Right? I mean, so that's the action, right, where they declare themselves independent and establish, they declare that the political connection between them and the states of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. And that is free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. So that paragraph is what gives us the reason to have the whole declaration. So Richard Henry Lee on June 7th had stood up in Congress and proposed basically that set of actions. And the way Congress worked was that they tended to pass a resolution and then set up a committee to draft the explanation for the resolution. So the rest of the declaration is the explanation for that final, that act. So that's really, you know, I always think it's good when you're reading the declaration to start there at the end, to read that last paragraph first, and then to ask yourself the question, what could possibly justify such an act? And there's a sense in which I think that answers the question of what Britain could have thought, because there's no way that Britain wanted in any way to justify such an act. So it was sort of a, you know, point of absolute disagreement.
But doesn't equality get sort of dropped out of the picture here if we're talking about the right to establish free and independent states?
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Okay. So, you know, the absolute end of the document, the very last sentence is the following. For the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. So there's this question about, you know, what are words worth? What good do you get just from declaring independence? And they answer that question here, where they pledge themselves to each other, and, you know, everything they have, their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor. That pledge to one another is an egalitarian bond that they formed amongst themselves. And it's that bond that gives them the strength to make, to turn their words into action, to make their words reality by being prepared to fight a war with Britain. So it's not the case that equality disappears at the end, mm-hmm. even though we focus on independence in the technical act that's being proposed. They can achieve their independence only because they've forged that egalitarian bond among themselves. So at the conclusion of the declaration, we see how fundamentally independence depends on equality.
And you see the repetition of the word our.
Absolutely.
And
exactly.
You write in your book that it's not my declaration, it's our declaration. How important is it that we don't have the use of the pronoun I anywhere in this declaration?
That's a terrific question. I mean, it's fundamental. Democracy is something that we do. there is no other way to think about democracy. And so then the question is, how on earth do you make that we real? And the only way to make it real is if there are genuinely egalitarian bonds in the people. Because the moment you lose equality among us, among all the members of the people, there's no we left. So that's the sense in which I think equality is fundamental and liberty depends on it.
You write, it's the last sentence in your book, it is time to let the Declaration once more be ours as it was always meant to be. Mm. That sounds as if you sort of are wanting to rescue it from somewhere it went and bring it back to being ours. What do you mean by that?
I mean several things. So let's see if I can get them all out here. At the first level, I mean that I'm speaking as an African-American, that the Declaration is mine. And it's not just the document that belongs to, say, white people, which I think our concern in the academy and outside of the academy about texts written by, quote unquote, dead white males has meant that some texts now seem to belong to some people and not to other people. And so I am making a claim that the Declaration belongs to me too as a black person, despite its compromises about slavery, despite the failures of the founding around slavery. So that's one sense in which I mean it. I also mean, though, that it's, when I say that, you know, it's mine too as a black person, I don't mean to say that it only belongs to black people. It belongs to all of us. And so in that regard, I am trying to reconstitute the whole we that includes black, white, brown, all of us, and focuses on the question of how we restore a bond of equality among us. You know, our public news, our public life is convulsed at the moment by our failure to make good on the commitment to equality. And this, I think, helps underscore that it really matters. I mean, there are real consequences that flow from whether or not we can take equality seriously. So it's our declaration because, again, it belongs to all of us in the country. But I want to remind everybody of the project that we have of becoming a we who are in this together. And I think that that project is badly frayed at the moment or damaged. It's not as strong as it's been at other points in time. And it's time to recover it.
You also talk about the need to actually read it closely, that what we've just been doing in this hour is sort of what you see families doing or students doing, but just to the act of reading you see as somehow very essential to being citizens.
That's a terrific point as well. So that is a third way in which I mean the idea of our declaration. So it's also the case that it doesn't just belong to the people of 1776. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read the very end of that second sentence again, because I think it conveys the way in which it's our declaration. That conclusion of that list of self-evident truths, to repeat it one last time, is that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends of securing our rights, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. In other words, the project of democracy is an ongoing project. Every generation has to revisit the principles on which we've organized our lives and the form that we've used to act those principles out and figure out what principles and form are most likely to affect our safety and happiness. So the Declaration is ours in that it gives us a blueprint for the basic project of democracy. And it's a blueprint that I think remains as valid today as it was in 1776. So it's ours in the present, not just something that belongs to the past.
My guest has been Danielle Ellen, and we have been talking about our declaration, and it is ours. You've made it that. Thank you so much for taking us through this document that I think we don't think closely enough about, perhaps.
Thank you so much, Emily. I really appreciate the conversation.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. We hold these